As it's a few minutes past the starting time, perhaps we should get going. Can you hear me? Is this okay? It's my great pleasure to welcome back to the Computer Laboratory Chris Bishop, without explosions this time, he tells me. Chris is chief research scientist at Microsoft Cambridge, just over the road, and also part-time professor in the computer science department at the University of Edinburgh. On a slightly more personal note, he's unique in my experience because during the daytime, I spend a lot of time recommending and discussing this excellent book on machine learning with my students. And now, when I go home in the evening, I find myself fielding questions from my children about the fairly recent Royal Institution lectures that he gave about just over a year ago. So that, I think, gives you some sense of the spread and impact of his work in computer science. So without more ado, let me hand over to Chris.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for the chance to come and give this talk this afternoon. I'm going to describe what I see as a new framework for machine learning, and it's something which I think is going to have a significant impact over the next 10 years. So I hope to convince you of that over the next hour or so, and to give you at least a flavor for what this is about and how it works. Now, this is not something that I've developed, nor is it something that my group at Microsoft Research Cambridge has developed. It's really something that has emerged from the worldwide community, many dozens of groups over the last 5 years, although it is an area where we focus strongly in my group in the building just across the road there. And by the way, I do very much welcome questions of clarification as we go through. If anything's not clear, just shout out, please. So let me begin by explaining what I mean by third generation. So I thought I'd start with a very, very brief, grossly oversimplified history of machine intelligence. So if you go back to the 1960s, 1970s, there was a lot of interest in the field of what was called artificial intelligence. And here's a lovely quote from Minsky, one of the sort of fathers of the field. Within a generation, the problem of creating artificial intelligence will largely be solved. So that was said in 1967. And this image here, I'm sure you recognize this. This is the one of the cameras from HAL, the computer on the spaceship in 2001. And the depiction there was of a machine in the year 2001 where you could have a general conversation about philosophy and all sorts of things. And it was very intelligent in a very general sense. And one of the main paradigms of that era was called expert systems. The idea was that you encapsulated expert knowledge from domain experts in the form of a big database of rules, and then you fired those rules in order to cause the machine to have some intelligence within that domain. And despite all the hype, there were lots of issues. The technique worked well in certain specific applications, but it didn't really yield a very general framework for machine intelligence. And one of the issues was the combinatorical explosion in the number of rules that was required to deal with all the exceptions and the exceptions to exceptions and so on. So let me sort of characterize sort of many decades or a couple of decades of research there by saying that the general theme of this era, as I see it, was one of handcrafted rules obtained from human domain experts. So if we move on to the late 1980s and beyond, sort of more or less up to the present time, we have a very, very different paradigm characterized by things like neural networks, support vector machines. And these are effectively statistical methods in which the solution is learned from large data sets. And this has had a lot of successes. Here's just one of thousands of examples. This is a handwriting recognition system, which is trained on literally millions of samples of handwritten words and actually performs extremely well. I think probably has reached the limit of what can be achieved purely at a sort of signal processing level. One of the difficulties, though, of these frameworks is that it's very difficult to incorporate the sort of expert domain knowledge that we talked about in that first generation paradigm. These are black box models. You have to work very, very hard even to build simple invariances into them, never mind anything more complex. And that, I think, is one of the big limitations of techniques like neural networks. So let me characterize again this huge body of research by describing this as a set of black box statistical models in which the solution is learned from large data sets. All right, so having primed your thought processes now, I'm going to describe a new framework for machine intelligence in which the key question is to see whether we can integrate these two paradigms. So if we can find a deep way of combining domain knowledge from experts with statistical learning from data. So that's the goal of this framework. And it's built on three key ideas. So let me go through, and I'll assume that you're not familiar with this material, although I know some of you certainly will be. So let me just give a very brief introduction to the three key ideas that underpin this new paradigm. So the first one is the idea of Bayesian learning, the idea of using probabilities to express uncertainty and then manipulating those probabilities using the very simple sum and product rules of probability theory. So the idea is this. Let's suppose that theta is a quantity of interest. We'd like to learn more about theta. And we'll suppose that capital X summarizes everything that we know so far, all the background knowledge we have about theta, also any data that we've already collected. Everything is summarized by this symbol X. And so we describe our current state of knowledge of theta by a probability distribution, P of theta, which is conditioned on all the information that we have so far. So P of theta given X. And we'll call that a prior distribution because this is the distribution we have before we observe the next little piece of data. So let's suppose the next thing we observe is X hat, little X hat. This is a new piece of data. And we want to incorporate this and somehow update our understanding of theta. In other words, we want to revise the probability distribution. Well, the rule for doing this is extremely simple. We need a function of theta called the likelihood function. This is not a distribution of a theta, it's a function of theta, and it's evaluated at the new data point x hat. All we have to do is to multiply the prior distribution by this likelihood function, and then up to a constant of proportionality, we get a new probability distribution of a theta, we'll call that the posterior distribution, which incorporates both all of the old stuff and the new piece of data. And I'll show you a little tutorial demo a little bit later where you can actually see that process in action. So that's the first key idea, the idea of using probabilities to quantify uncertainty. The second key ingredient is the framework of probabilistic graphical models. So here's an example of a graphical model. This is a directed graph, a graph with arrows. Essentially, there is a node in the graph, one node for each variable. So this is a problem where there are three variables, x1, x2, x3. And the graph tells us something about the distributions over those three variables. To be specific, the graph defines a family of distributions, which is a subset of the set of all possible distributions. So think of the graph as a sort of constraint. The missing links in the graph encode constraint. So here's a graph which is not fully connected, there's a missing link, and so it constrains the set of distributions that we're considering. And it constrains them in a specific way, which can be described by a factorization. So this graph tells us that the joint probability distribution over these three variables factorizes in a certain very specific way. And I don't want to delve into technical details, but just to summarize what's going on for this particular graph, it says that the joint distribution is the product of a distribution for each of these three variables conditioned on the parents of that variable in the graph. So if you look at these two nodes, the arrow goes from x1 to x3, so we call x1 the parent, we call x3 the child. And so we have a distribution over x1 conditioned on its parents, there aren't any. Similarly for x2. And then times the distribution over x3 conditioned on its parents, which are x1 and x2. So this describes the way in which the joint distribution factorizes into a set of factors, each of which depends potentially on only a subset of all the variables in the model. And I haven't said anything here about whether these are discrete or continuous, so actually this is describing whole family of distributions which satisfy that factorization property. And it's this graph structure that we'll use to capture the domain knowledge. And again, I'll show you a concrete real-world example of that a little bit later on with a much more complex graph. And then the third key ingredient, which is what allows us to take this framework and scale it to very large applications, as you'll see, are techniques for doing inference efficiently. And there are several aspects to this, so let's just look at a toy example. Let's suppose that we have some function of two variables, x and y, and the function is actually just the function x times y, And we want to sum this function over all possible values of x and y. Now, this is sort of a prototype for the kinds of calculations that we need to do when we're applying Bayesian inference and making predictions. And we'll suppose that x and y can each just take two values, as you can see here. So this summation can be expressed analytically in this form. Now, we can make use of the factorization to express it in a slightly different form. So we can rewrite it in this form, which is analytically equivalent, but numerically it's very different. The first form involves four multiplications followed by three additions. There are seven numerical steps in the top expression, whereas this one involves two additions and one multiplication, so it's been reduced from seven down to three. And so what we're doing is we're making use of the factorization to set out our calculations in a way that's computationally efficient. And for example, if we had a large tree-structured graph, then a naive calculation would grow, in terms of computational cost, would grow exponentially with the size of the graph. But if we order the calculations carefully, it grows only linearly with the size of the graph. So we're using the graph structure to help us set out the calculations that we need to do in a way that's computationally efficient. And, of course, the software that we construct can mirror the structure of the graph. So I've said that we use graphs to express factorization, and we use factorization to set out the computation in a way that's numerically efficient. So it therefore follows that we can use the graphs to express the way in which that efficiency is encapsulated. And in particular, that turns out to involve simple local message passing around the graph. So if we consider this very simple graph with just three nodes, and let's suppose that we observe the value for one of these variables. So the notation is we'll shade a node in, means the value for that node has been observed. Think of it as some data. We've collected the data. We've measured the value. We've measured the blood pressure of one of our patients or whatever it might be. And we're interested in knowing something about some other variable in the graph. So we previously had what effectively is a prior distribution over this variable. We've collected some new data. We now want to compute a posterior distribution. We want to update the distribution in light of the new data. So the calculations can be set out efficiently by making use of the factorization. The factorization is expressed in terms of the structure of the graph, and so the calculations boil down to messages being passed locally from node to node on the graph. So we might pass a message there and then another message there, and having passed those messages, we can update the distribution at this node. So we're just using the sum and product rule of probability, but we're setting out the calculations in a way that's numerically efficient. Now, the example I showed you so far was of simple discrete variables with two states in which we had to do simple summations that were very easy, but often we have to do integrations in which we deal with continuous variables in which those integrations can't be done in closed form. So they're analytically intractable. So what are we going to do in that instance? Everything I've said so far, I've talked about graphical models, I've talked about Bayesian inference. These are all actually quite old ideas. I mean, Bayesian inference goes back a couple of hundred years. Graphical models have been around for decades. What's the new ingredient in all this? Well, really, this is the new ingredient. This is the thing which has really been developed in the last 5 years, which allows us to take these methods and apply them to very large-scale data sets. So let's suppose that this red curve depicts the what I call the true distribution, that is the probability distribution described by our model. Now, I've drawn it schematically as a distribution in some one-dimensional space. But, of course, this is a multi-dimensional space involving thousands or even millions of variables. So think of this as a complex distribution in an extremely high-dimensional space. And typically, it's not a simple Gaussian, it's something very complex. And we want to do things like take integrals across that space in order to make predictions. And we'll suppose that those integrals are intractable, as they will be for everything except for a very toy problem. Well, until a few years ago, we really only had one sort of general purpose method for tackling these types of problems. That's called Monte Carlo methods, usually based on Markov chain simulation. And the idea is that replacing the idea is instead of working in this continuous space, what we do is we draw samples from the distribution. So we run a big computer code which outputs samples whose distribution is governed by this red curve. And now integrals along this axis are now simply replaced by summations evaluated at each of these discrete points. So the integrals become trivial provided we can draw a number of samples independently from that distribution. The problem, so the advantage of this approach actually is that it's very, very general purpose. We can apply these methods to a very broad class of models. So that's the good news. The other good news is that in most cases, this will give us the exact result, the result that we would have got if we'd done the true integral over this distribution, if we have infinite computer resources. There's a sort of an asymptotic limit in which we're guaranteed to get the right answer. In practice, what happens is that it's computationally extremely costly, so that people typically would work with very small data sets of hundreds or thousands of data points. Now, for example, David Spiegelhalter over in the maths department, over the last 20 years or so, has developed some very nice applications of Bayesian methods using graphical models based on Monte Carlo techniques like Gibbs sampling and other more sophisticated methods, which in a sense fall into the framework that I'm describing. But because they use Monte Carlo methods, they're computationally very costly, typically limited to a few hundred or a few thousand data points. What's happened in the last few years is the development of a whole set of new techniques for approximating these integrals over high-dimensional complex probability distributions. And they have a whole bunch of different names, but they're all characterized by the fact that they are approximations in a different sense. They're not numerical approximations, they're analytical or deterministic approximations. So, again, to describe this very schematically, let's suppose the red curve is the distribution we'd like to work with, but it's intractable. Let's approximate that with a simpler distribution, which I've shown here in green. So imagine, let's say, that's just a Gaussian distribution. Now, that really, of course, is a whole family of distributions. It's described by two variables, the mean and the variance. And so we can explore that family of distributions. We can adjust the mean, adjust the variance, to find the best fit between the green approximation and the red distribution, which is the true distribution. And according to the family of approximations we use, according to the definition of what we mean by closest fit, according to the way we set out those calculations, those computations, we arrive at various different techniques, variational Bayes, expectation propagation, and so on. And the development of these techniques is the subject of very active research. So these have one thing in common, which is they're computationally very efficient, and with these we can scale up to extremely large data sets, and I'll show you some examples later. So those are really the key ingredients in this new framework. Unless anybody has any questions at this point, What I'll do is I'll show you a very simple tutorial example. This is a totally a toy problem. In fact, it's so simple we could actually just solve it analytically using pencil and paper. We'll pretend we can't do that. We'll apply this message passing framework using all the ingredients I've described in order to solve this problem. So imagine we want to test a new drug. We want to see whether it's effective or not. So we might do the following. We'll get a whole set of participants, and each of these participants is suffering from some kind of a disease. And each of these participants will be given at random in this blind trial either either the new drug or a placebo. And then after a while, we notice that some of the patients recover from this disease and others do not recover. And the question we want to know is the drug different from the placebo, or is the way in which it's acting consistent with it being no different from the placebo? So we want to know, given the evidence from the data we've collected about which patients recover and which don't, we want to know, is the drug statistically different from the placebo or not? So what we're going to do, first of all, is to construct the graph. So we construct the graph that describes the problem. So we begin by introducing a random variable. This is a binary random variable called different. If different is equal to 1, that means the drug and the placebo are acting differently. And if it's 0, it means they're indistinguishable. We don't know whether they're different or not, so we'll have some prior, possibly very weak prior distribution over whether they're different or whether they're the same. Now, this binary variable acts like a kind of switch. So here's another piece of sort of graphical machinery. It's called a gate. You can think of this as just a simple switch. If this variable is true, in other words, if the drug and the placebo were different, then we switch to this piece, the piece of graphical model that will appear in this box, and if they're the same, we switch instead to the piece of graphical model inside that box. So let's suppose for the moment that they are different. We can then introduce two new random variables. So this yellow one is the probability that you'll be cured if you are given the drug. And similarly, this is the probability that you'll be cured if you're given the placebo. And because they're acting differently, these are different variables. They can take different values. Now we have our participants, and let's look at five of them here. Some of them are given the drug, some of them are given the placebo. The ones that are given the drug may or may not recover from the disease, and whether they do will be governed by the probability of their being cured. Likewise, for the people who take the placebo, they will either recover or not, but the probability of them recovering will be governed by this potentially different probability, the probability of cure if you take the placebo. After all, you might recover from the disease even if you don't take the drug. On the other hand, let's suppose that actually the drug and the placebo are acting in the same way, that there's no difference between them. Then they should share a common variable, which is the probability of being cured. That will be the same probability for everybody. So in that case, all of the participants will have a probability of recovery governed by this single shared variable. So that's sort of the first stage. The first stage is we construct a probabilistic model expressed as a graph which captures our knowledge, our understanding of the situation that we're trying to describe. The second stage is that we go out and we collect data. So let's suppose that three of these participants recover from the disease and two of them do not recover. So we've now made observations. Having made observations, we can now update those probability distributions. So in particular, we're interested in learning about these various probabilities of recovering or not recovering. And we're particularly interested in learning about whether the drug is different from the disease. Now, as I said, in this simple example, we could just write down the solution analytically, but in more complex cases, and in most practical cases, that's not true. We have to make approximations. So we're going to make approximations, in this case, using a framework called expectation propagation, in which we take the complex distribution and we constantly map it back to a simpler family. And that process of approximation, as I've already indicated, can be expressed in terms of local message passing around the graph. So we have a sequence of messages which are passed around the graph, and we continue to pass these messages until we satisfy some kind of convergence criterion. Once we've converged, we can then read off the distributions, and that's our answer. So let's have a little demo of this. So in this demo, the top row of this matrix represents people who have taken the drug, and the bottom row represents people who've taken the placebo. The green column are people who recover from the disease, and the red column is people who do not recover from the disease. This slider here indicates whether the drug and the placebo are different. So down here, the bottom end would be certain the drug and placebo are different, and up here would be certain that they're the same. And for the moment, we don't know, so we've just set this to 0.5. And then over here, we have some distributions. This is the probability distribution for that variable on the left-hand side. This variable here, this is a variable which tells us the probability that somebody will be cured if they've taken the drug. And we don't know what that probability is, we're uncertain, so we describe it by a distribution. So this is a probability distribution over the probability of being cured, and it's represented by a histogram, and at the moment it's completely flat. This one similarly is the probability of being cured given you take the placebo, and there's one more probability that I haven't shown, the probability of being cured if the drug and the placebo are the same. And just for lack of screen space, that's not shown, but it behaves in the way you'd expect. Okay, at the moment we've seen no data, so let's add in some data. And as we add in the data, the demo will run that message passing algorithm and update these probabilities. So here we've got some people who've taken the drug and they've been cured, and maybe some people who've taken the drug and unfortunately they weren't cured. Some people who took the placebo, they got better anyway, very powerful effect, the placebo effect. But, you know, perhaps quite a lot of them who took the placebo didn't get better. So what do we learn from this sort of data? What we learn is that if the drug and the placebo were different, then the probability of getting cured has now become a sharper distribution, shifted over towards the right. So two things are happening here. If we have the same number of people cured and not cured, we see this is a distribution which is peaked around 0.5. There's a 50-50 chance of being cured if you take the drug. But it's a narrower distribution. And as we observe more and more data, let's just fill that up, it becomes a narrow distribution. It's still centered about 0.5. We observed a lot more data. The distribution has become narrow. Uncertainty has been reduced. We've learned from data in this Bayesian sense. The other thing that's going on is that top node, which is telling us about whether the placebo and the drug are statistically different or not. So here we've got a situation where whether you take the drug or whether you take the placebo, you're still, you know, there's sort of a 50-50 chance of getting cured. It doesn't make a huge difference. And this slider tells us the probability that they were the same, and actually it's leaning more towards them being the same rather than different. And on the other hand, if we had the situation that we might want to observe if we were the drug company, which is that there's a huge difference, like this, then we're becoming very, very confident that this data is telling us that the drug and the placebo were different. It's saying there's very, very unlikely for that skew distribution to have arisen purely by chance. Any questions about that demo? Okay. So that's just a toy demo. What I want to do for the rest of the talk is to go through some case studies, sort of real-world case studies that illustrate the application of this framework, and hopefully bring out some of those basic ideas again in a little bit more detail. These, and I've chosen, by the way, case studies, all of which were developed in the machine learning group in Microsoft Research Cambridge. Obviously, there are other examples I could have given from other research groups as well. So let's begin with quite a simple application in a sense, but of great practical importance. This is Bing, which is Microsoft's search engine, competing with Google and other search engines. And this is what happens if you type in LCD. Perhaps you want to buy a new LCD television, or you're wondering how liquid crystals work or something. And what you get is a set of a ranked list of links taking you to web pages that talk about LCDs. You get something else as well. You get adverts because search, well, it's called free search. It isn't free. Of course, it's monetized through advertising. And so we have some main adverts up here and then some sort of sidebar adverts down the side. And from a commercial point of view, the challenge here is to decide which advertisements to show. Now, the way this works is that the people whose adverts are shown have bid in a kind of an auction system. They've offered so many cents or so many dollars to have their advertisement shown, but they don't get paid for having their ad shown. They only get paid if the ad is actually clicked. So they're really bidding on having their advert shown, but they only pay if the advert is clicked. Now, different people will bid different sums of money to be shown in a particular slot. So the challenge from the point of view of the search engine provider, in order to maximize their expected return, they have to take into account not only the amount that was bid for that advert, but also the probability that it's being clicked. Because the expected revenue that the search engine provider will receive is the product of the bid times the probability that the advert is clicked. It's slightly more complicated than that. It's actually a second price auction, so you actually pay the cost of the next bid in the sequence. But that's irrelevant. The key point here is that at the very heart of this, we have to estimate the probability that an advertisement will be clicked. The better you are at estimating those probabilities, the better you will be at choosing the right ads to show along with each page of search results, and the more money you'll make by running your search engine. So that's the heart of this, is estimating what's called the click-through rate. So here's a simple way that you might choose to do this. You take a whole bunch of features, and I've shown three of them here, but there might be dozens or hundreds of them. And each of these features, we'll suppose, can take one out of a number of possible values. So for a particular advertisement, each of these features takes on some specific value. Now what we can do is we could learn a weight parameter, a continuous parameter associated with each of these values for each of these features. And then to predict the click-through rate, we simply add up the values of those parameters. So we get some continuous real-valued number here. And we pass it through what's called a squashing function. That's a function such as a cumulative Gaussian, which takes the real axis and maps it onto the interval from 0 to 1. And that quantity can therefore be interpreted as a probability of that advert being clicked. And obviously we'd want to run this through all the possible advertisements that we might show in response to that search query, and then we rank them, not by the probability of being clicked, nor by the bid, but by the product of those two, because that's the expected return on investment in showing that particular advert. Now, this doesn't take into account uncertainty, so we can make this into a Bayesian system by recognizing that we don't know the values for these weights and therefore describing them by probability distributions. So imagine we might initialize these to, say, very broad Gaussian distributions, and then on the basis of historical data of what people clicked on, we can use Bayesian inference to refine those distributions and learn to build a better click model. So what we have now is a probability distribution over each parameter, one parameter per value for each of the features. And now when we add up the value, so for a particular advertisement, we'll take one of these weights from here, one from here, and so on. When we add up the weights, we get a Gaussian distribution over their sum. We pass that through the squashing function, and we now get a probability distribution over the probability of click. So this is a graph of some results from the Bing search engine. This shows the predicted click-through rate, the predicted probability of click versus the actual probability of click on some measured data. And it's showing a comparison actually between two models. This is the ad predictor system, the system I've just described, the Bayesian inference system. This is what happens if we use a well-known statistical model called naive Bayes. Naive Bayes says that for each class, that's whether the advert is clicked or whether it's not clicked, all of those features are independent of each other. And you can see that the naive Bayes model is doing very much worse than the ad predictor model. The basic reason for this is a lot of those features are very highly correlated. Take an extreme example. Imagine one feature was actually replicated, so it's perfectly those two features are perfectly correlated. Then the naive Bayes model treats them as independent. So if you have two copies of the feature, it gives twice as much weight to that feature. There's sort of double counting of evidence. Whereas in the Bayesian model, with its message passing, it correctly distributes the credit, it spreads the credit across correlated features in just the right way according to the rules of probability. So that's one advantage of having that Bayesian inference model. Here's another advantage. Here's something else you can do if you have probabilities that you can't do if you simply have a point estimate of the probability of being clicked. So imagine that we have two adverts, one of them represented by the red distribution, one by the blue distribution. So this is a graph of the probability distribution over the click-through rate versus the click-through rate itself, the probability of being clicked. So we see that on average, we would expect the red advert to be clicked 30% of the time, but expect the blue advert to be clicked 25% of the time. So if the bids, the dollar bids for those two adverts are the same, then our maximum expected return would be obtained simply by always choosing the red advert, because that's a higher probability of being clicked. The problem is if we never show the blue advert, we never learn anything about the blue. It might be a great advert, but we've just never shown it, so we don't know that people like to click on it a lot. So we have a basic trade-off. It's called the exploration-exploitation trade-off. Sometimes we need to show advertisements that seem to have a low click-through rate, but we're rather uncertain about their click-through rate in order to learn more about it. So there's a trade-off. And a simple way to make that trade-off would be, instead of always picking the distribution with the higher mean, simply to draw samples from these distributions and pick whichever is higher. So you draw a sample from the red curve, draw one from the blue curve, and pick whichever is higher. And that means, although more often you'll choose something from the red curve, you will occasionally choose something from the blue curve. So sometimes you'll do some exploration. A lot of the time you'll do exploitation of what you already know. So that's one example of the benefits of having a probabilistic model rather than simply making point predictions. And it's also another interesting example, because what I call a sort of planet-scale application of Bayesian inference is an example of Bayesian inference that's running. This, incidentally, this algorithm is now running on 100% of the US search traffic, and Microsoft has something like a 10% share of the search market in the US, so it's processing literally billions of data points through this algorithm. And that's something we couldn't conceive of doing using Monte Carlo methods. Okay, let me give you another case study now, very, very different domain and a slightly more complex model now. This is the problem of ranking. So the problem in general is that we want to construct a global ranking of a number of entities, and that what we're given is partial rankings, and those partial rankings are noisy. So a simple example would be chess. So if you imagine we're all members of a chess club, and we'd like to construct a sort of a leader table showing who's the best, who's the second best, and so on. Now, the data that we have is the result of chess games. Now, chess games are played by just pairs of people. So you and I might play a game of chess. One of us wins, one loses. Then you two play, and so on. And after we have all these results from pairs of chess games, we could then try to construct the global ranking. And the other problem is that this is not only these partial rankings we're given, but they're noisy. That is to say, while the stronger player will win against the weaker player most of the time, occasionally the weaker player will beat the stronger player. And obviously, the closer they are in strength, the more often the weaker player is likely to win. Now, there's a standard approach to this. It's called ELO, named after the inventor. It's not an acronym. That's the name of the inventor. And ELO is very widely used. For example, it's used worldwide in chess. And it's in fact, it's a maximum likelihood system. It assigns a score or a strength to every player. So if you're a chess player, your ELO strength might be 130. And there's a little algorithm which says that when you play against somebody and you win, your score goes up a little bit and the other player's score goes down a little bit. And the various problems with this, it can't handle team games. It can't handle more than two players. But also, it's not probabilistic. And we'll see how, by going to a Bayesian probabilistic model, we gain some very big advantages. So how are we going to do this in a probabilistic setting? So again, the first thing to do is to construct our graph. So let's suppose, first of all, we have just two players, player one and player two, and they're going to play a game of chess. Now, we assign a variable to each of these players, which is their strength. So S1 is the strength of player one. We don't know their strength, so we'll assign a distribution. We'll make it a Gaussian distribution. So their strength is now described not by a single number now, but by two numbers, a mean and a variance or uncertainty. So each of these players has a mean and a variance for their strength. And now they're going to play a particular game of chess. Now, for this particular game of chess, we'll introduce the idea of a performance. So player one delivers a particular performance on this game of chess, which is a noisy version of their skill. The higher their skill, the higher their performance, but the performance will vary randomly about their skill. And then whichever player has the higher performance will win the game of chess. So this is a graph of the performance of player one against the performance of player two. This dotted line is the skill of player one. This is the skill of player two. And this distribution represents the distribution of performances for this particular game. And essentially, the blue region is the region in which the performance of player one is greater than the performance of player two, and so player one is the winner. And similarly for the red region. So now, when we actually play this game of chess, we'll observe the value for this variable. We'll observe, let's say, that player two, who is the stronger player in this case, actually wins. So we have these prior distributions up here, which are not shown in the diagram. And now we have what's a likelihood function. And the likelihood function is quite simple. It says that regions out here have been set to zero. We've observed that player two is the winner. That corresponds to the red region. So this distribution is like a Gaussian distribution, but which is sort of a hump, but kind of with a piece cut off the side. So take a Gaussian distribution, cut a piece off the side, and you're left with a non-Gaussian distribution. Now, we're going to go on and now have lots and lots of chess games. And if you've got 1,000 players, we're going to start with a Gaussian distribution in 1,000 dimensions. And every time we observe a chess result, we're going to cut a piece off this Gaussian in some direction. We're going to end up with a geometrically very, very complex and intractable shape. So we're going to apply, again, expectation propagation, which in this case amounts to something very simple. It says, take this non-Gaussian distribution that's got a piece cut off and project it back into the family of Gaussian distributions, because they're nice and tractable. And in fact, the way you do that is very simple. You just write down the, or calculate the Gaussian distribution whose mean invariance is the same as the mean invariance of this complicated non-Gaussian distribution. Now, the nice thing about this is, unlike ELO, we can easily extend this to team games and more complex situations just by drawing the corresponding graph. So here's a situation in which team one has a single player, team two has two players, and teams one and two play a game here, and then later team two play against team three, which again just has a single player. So we're going to build up this very complex graph that represents the interactions between all these players. And of course, if we think of a team game like football, where you always have 11 people in a team, as long as over a period of time the membership of the teams get shuffled up, this will automatically do a credit assignment, so even though we only have the results from teams, we'll eventually be able to work out that a particular player is a strong player, another player is a weak player, even though we only have team results, as long as the teams get shuffled up enough that we don't have a credit assignment problem. So here's a result from applying this, not to chess, but to a console computer game called Halo. And this is a plot of the number of games played versus the estimated skill level. Think of that as the mean of the distribution. As a function of time for two players. So this data is taken from a much, much larger data set. So these players are not just playing against each other, they're playing against lots of other players. And this is how ELO estimates their strength and how that strength evolves with time. And notice this is up to 400 games at the end of this diagram. Here's the same data analyzed using the Bayesian ranking system. And you see a very dramatic difference. You see that the convergence is very much more rapid in terms of the number of games played. And the reason for that is because we have not just a point estimate, we have variances. So let's think about a situation in which you're 120, I'm 130, but we play a game and you win, so the weaker player has won. Now in ELO, we can make a little bit of a, we can increase your score a little bit, we can reduce mine a little bit, and we go off and play the next game. But in the Bayesian ranking system, we also have an uncertainty. Now let's suppose that I've been playing for years and years and years, there's lots of data about me, and we know that my distribution is 130 plus or minus 1. So I've got quite a narrow distribution over my skill uncertainty because there's a lot of data about me. Let's suppose you're a newcomer, you're 120, you've only played a few games, you're 120 plus or minus 10. We're quite uncertain about your skill level. Because you've just beaten somebody who's 130 plus or minus 1, what the rules of probability will do is in one step will make a very big change to your score. I mean, loosely speaking, it will increase the mean of your distribution up to 129, and it will shrink the variance a little bit because we've learned something about your skill. So knowing the variances as well as the means allows the system, just automatically, to make big changes when big changes are justified. And that's why the system converges in much fewer games than the ELO system. And again, that's useful in practical applications. So this algorithm has been running live on a Microsoft games console called Xbox 360, which comes with an online service called Xbox Live. It was launched in September 2005, and this system, this Bayesian inference system under the name of TrueSkill, provides the ranking system for all Xbox 360 live games. So this has been running since September 2005, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, processing millions of game outcomes per day. So again, another example of a planet-scale application of Bayesian inference that would have been inconceivable without these fast, deterministic, approximate inference methods based on message passing. Okay, let me give you one final case study. Again, a very, very different field. This is from the biomedical field, and this is a collaboration with the clinicians at the University of Manchester. This is called the Manchester Asthma and Allergy Study, and this is a study that's been going about 11 years now. And it involves about 1,000 children. It's a birth cohort study, so about 1,000 children are recruited at birth into this study, and they've been monitored about every couple of years. And when they're monitored, a huge amount of information is collected. We now have something like 2,000 variables per child. So not only things like their height and weight are measured and so on, but their lung function is measured in great detail. They spend literally several hours sitting inside a sealed chamber, breathing in and out of a tube. Various lung functions are measured. They have to breathe in a substance which induces an artificial asthma attack, would you believe? And they're titrated on the quantity of this substance. The amount is doubled each time until they show the first symptoms of asthma attack, and that's noted down, and that's their sort of propensity to suffer from asthma. Blood samples are taken, blood proteins are measured, skin prick tests are done to determine allergies to peanut and house mites and dust and all sorts of things. And lots of information is collected, information about whether they have furry animals at home, whether they have siblings, whether they were a cesarean birth or not, and so on. And even the dust from the carpets at home are sort of hoovered up, and those are analysed for toxins. So a very, very rich data set for these 1,000 children. Now, just recently, we've also taken the DNA from these children and had it, what are called single nucleotide polymorphisms measured. That's genetic variations located at specific individual sites on the genome. There are about 700,000 of these sites have been measured for each of these 1,000 children. Now, why are we very excited about this? The reason we're excited about this is because asthma, like many diseases, is a very, very complex disease. People have looked for a number of years at the environmental causes of asthma, and no clear picture has really emerged. And people have looked for the genetic causes of asthma. There are about 100 papers claiming to have found, you know, a gene responsible for asthma. But actually, the picture is very complex and very muddy, because different studies find different genes. And even when they find the same genes, it's sometimes different points on the gene where the variability is associated with asthma. And in some cases, where it's the same gene and the same base pair that's responsible, in some studies, one variant is increases the chance of getting asthma, and in a different study, the same variant decreases the chance of getting asthma. So I think it's fair to say that the whole thing is very, very complex and very, very muddly. On the other hand, asthma is extremely important. It's one of the four big chronic diseases of childhood. It's very important to understand it. It's also increasing in prevalence. Again, that's not understood. So we're bringing these machine learning techniques to bear to really take a different look at this problem. And our approach really is as follows. People have tried to look at the relationship between genetic variability and the presence or absence of asthma. And that's where these are called genome-wide association studies. They're huge statistical studies. Hundreds of these have been done. And the results are very muddy and inconclusive. Now, imagine you go back a few hundred years where people suffer from this disease. And the disease is called fever. And you try to find, you know, the environmental or genetic causes of fever. Again, you'd be very, very muddly. Because fever is not a single disease. There are many different diseases that previously were labeled fever. The hypothesis that we're working on is that asthma is a complex disease. The symptoms could be representative of different underlying processes, different underlying causes. And furthermore, there may not be a simple genetic variant that causes asthma any more than there's a simple environmental factor that causes asthma, but these could interact in complex ways. And in fact, previous studies have identified at least one reasonably robust situation in which there's an interaction between environment and genetics. It's quite interesting, actually, where if you, as a child, are exposed to furry animals, there's a tendency to have a greater propensity to have asthma. But it's only a small effect. When the genetics were studied, it turns out that there are two groups of children. If you have a particular genetic variant, then it doesn't matter whether you're exposed to furry animals. If you have the other genetic variant, you're actually quite sensitive to the presence of furry animals. So there's an interaction between the genes and environment that gets washed out, gets marginalized out if you don't measure the genetics. So we've got a very exciting data set here from our collaborators in Manchester. We have this extremely rich phenotype and environmental data, and now we have state-of-the-art genetic information. So what we're doing is something that's very different from what's usually done in this field. So the usual thing to do is some very simple statistical techniques to look for correlations between gene and environment. What we do is something very different. We build a big, complex graphical model. And I think this is a good example of what I meant by capturing expert domain knowledge. So this block diagram is the result of several months of sitting down with the clinicians in Manchester and sucking out their expert knowledge on the factors that influence asthma and their relationship to each other. You probably can't read the details. The details aren't important. I'm just showing you that it's a complicated diagram. But here is sort of asthma in the middle. There are factors to do with lung function, factors with airway inflammation, factors to do with what's called bronchial hyperresponsiveness. Over here are various prenatal factors. Nutrition is up here. Presence of adult smokers is here. These are lung function measurements. Genetics is appearing up here. Let's just look at one part of this. So we'll just take one part of this diagram. And this is not yet a graphical model. It's just a block diagram. If we take a piece of it and expand it out, this is what the actual graph looks like. So these boxes are, again, another graphical construction. They're called a plate, and they simply say that everything inside that box is replicated. So this big plate out here is labeled children, and are just over 1,000. So there are 1,000 children. There are 1,000 copies of everything inside that box. This box here is looking at allergens, and there are mite, cat, dog, pollen, egg, milk, mold, and peanuts. There are 8 allergens. So there are 8 copies of everything inside this box. And this graph along here, this is deep down in here, is something called a hidden Markov model that some of you would be familiar with from speech recognition, handwriting recognition, tracking, and so on. This describes the way in which an unobserved quantity, which is the propensity for the child to become sensitized, how that varies with age. So this column is age 1, age 3, age 5, age 8. And these are variables. These are rather like those probabilities of the drug or the placebo causing somebody to be cured or not. And these are shared across all of these variables. So again, the details don't matter. The point is we've constructed a complex graphical model whose structure tries to capture the domain knowledge from the experts. In this case, very detailed, very rich domain knowledge. What we then do is we go out and we collect data. And now we do the statistical learning. So this row here represents the results of the skin test measurements for each of the 8 allergens, for each of the 1,000 children, at each of age 1, 3, 5, and 8. This row here is the same thing, but these are immunoglobulin E protein measurements from blood tests, again, for every allergen, for every child, for every age. And we can now run our inference algorithms until we get convergence, and then we can read off things like the probability of gaining sensitization between age 1 and age 3, and such things. But most interesting of all is we've introduced another variable up here, which is we call that the sensitization class. You can think of this as very, very complex clustering. This is a variable which can take on a certain small discrete number of values, and the posterior distribution over that variable tells us how the children are grouped into different classes based purely on this allergy data. And here's a little plot of what this looks like. So these are the 5 classes. So each of these is one of those clusters that we've discovered in this kind of unsupervised way. These are skin tests at age 1, 3, 5, and 8, and this is the blood proteins at age 1, 3, 5, and 8. Roughly speaking, green means no sensitization, blue means one example of sensitization, and red means 2 or more. So think of red meaning sensitized to 2 or more of these allergens. And what we find is that of the children in this group, quite a high proportion, 42%, have asthma, and that's compared to the best standard accepted clinical prediction for asthma based on this data, which gives about 22%. It's called ATP and is very widely used. And I'm very pleased to say that just on Monday we learned that this work has been accepted for publication in this journal, which is actually the world's leading respiratory medicine journal. We're very excited about it because we had a lot of fun with the referees, as you can imagine, because we didn't just take the data and run some standard statistical package. We're proposing an entirely new framework for analysing this data. Now, why is this interesting? This is interesting because these classes were discovered without using any information about whether the child had asthma or not. So the hope, the agenda of this research program, is that these classes, these discovered hidden classes, will be more significant than the simple observation of whether a general practitioner has labeled this child as having asthma or not. So the hope is that when we look for correlations between genetic variability and these hidden classes, we'll find a much stronger signal than when we simply look at the relationship between genetic variability and the presence or absence of something called asthma as defined by a general practitioner. So that's the hope. It's early stages, but we're, as you probably tell, very excited about this. Somebody's already mentioned a very good textbook, so I won't dwell on that one. But let me tell you about this. This is also very exciting. This is a framework for doing inference on the kinds of models I've described. This has been developed by my colleagues in Microsoft Research. It's available for free download from this site for any non-commercial purposes. And it really is intended to be industrial strength software which will work at scale and which implements a very broad range of graphical models and also several of the most important of these deterministic inference algorithms based on message passing. And lots of tutorials. There's also lots of online help. There's a user group and so on. So quite an active research community. So if you want to play with these models, do download info.net. Lots of simple tutorials like the drug trial example that I showed and many others. In many cases, these are implemented with 10 or 20 lines of code. So you can think of info.net effectively as like a probabilistic programming language, very easy to use. So I do encourage you to take a look at that. All right, let me, with 2 minutes to go, wrap up then. So I've tried to convince you that there's a sort of a new paradigm here for machine learning, and this paradigm is built on 3 ideas, 2 of them fairly old and 1 of them fairly new. First of all, we use a Bayesian formulation. We use probabilities to quantify uncertainty, and learning now becomes the reduction in uncertainty as a result of seeing new data. We use probabilistic graphical models to capture domain knowledge to express the structure of our model, and then once we've collected the data, we solve the model and compute posterior distributions using these fast deterministic inference algorithms, which are based on passing local messages around on the graph. The goal of this is to provide a generic, flexible framework that scales, which allows us to make a deep integration of complex domain knowledge together with statistical learning. So in a sense, combining the best of both worlds of the previous 2 paradigms of machine intelligence. And finally, I've mentioned info.net, which is a toolkit you can download if you want to play with this for yourselves. Okay, thank you very much.
So we have time for questions, but if you'd like to ask a question, please wait until I give you the microphone.
Thank you. I enjoyed that talk very much. It seems that getting the right graphical model or domain model, whatever, is obviously the key bit. And, I mean, you call it domain knowledge. It's a little bit sort of problematic as a sort of a technique as went back, because somebody has to know what's actually there. Are there means, do you think, that you can sort of play with slightly less well constructed graphical models and then perhaps, you know, come towards a better schema over time? So sort of take the unsupervised machine learning stuff and this, but perhaps by having a less good model in the first place and then you know, making it more generally applicable.
Yeah, that's a good question. So 2 comments, really. The first one is, so taking that to its extreme, you might like to learn the structure of the model from data rather than have to get it from experts. I haven't emphasized that because I think the framework that I've discussed here, where you fix the structure of the model after discussion with your domain experts and then you run inference, is quite robust and it's quite well defined. From a research point of view, it's very interesting to ask, can we learn the structure of the model? But now it becomes much more challenging. So in terms of a tool that you can apply today in large-scale practical applications, I think that isn't yet mature enough. It's a fascinating and very important research topic, but it's not robust enough. The space of models is too big, and it's just too difficult to demonstrate in synthetic studies that you're able to reconstruct the true graph from data. It's a very, very hard problem to solve. Another comment is perhaps related to your question, which is that You talked about doing things in a slightly more unsupervised way and not necessarily having to constrain everything by the domain knowledge. And in a sense, the ASMR example was an example of that. So we introduced this extra latent variable, which was the sensitization class. And we said, let's group all the children into five groups, and we'll hope that those represent the underlying disease in some way. We don't imagine for a moment that the true biochemistry of asthma in any way is described by this single binary variable. It's something much more complex, and we just kind of summarized it. So in a sense, that variable is not representing anything we necessarily think really exists in the true world. Rather, it's a sort of a summary of something much more complex that's, although it's much simpler than reality, gives us a bit more structure than we get in a simple binary asthma yes, no. So perhaps that's an example of something where we're constructing the model not entirely based on domain knowledge, but just simply, in that case, looking for unsupervised clustering.
Local message passing bit seems rather mysterious and magical. Could you say a little bit about it?
I could say lots about it. I've glossed over the technical details of that a little bit. So it becomes a little bit less mysterious and magical when you do what we do in practice, which is we take these director graphs, we map them onto something else called a factor graph. And a factor graph has a separate node for each variable and a separate node for each factor and shows how they're connected to each other. And then on those graphs, it's 5 or 10 minutes of algebra to describe how you... I'm not sure I can even bring up the PowerPoint, but it's one of those things, a little 10-minute exercise to show how to compute a local marginal. Okay, think of it like this. You've got a model that involves, say, 10 variables. So you've got the joint distribution over all 10 things. But supposing those 10 things are laid out on a chain and they're just connected neighbor by neighbor. Now, it's really now the product of lots of factors, and each factor just depends on a pair of the variables. Now, supposing I want just the marginal over one of those variables, that means I have to sum out everything else. That's the sum rule of probability to be left with that one variable. Think about one of those sums. It's a sum over just one of the variables, and that variable only appears in a pair of the factors, right? The factor where it connects to the right and the factor where it connects to the left. So it only appears in that one place. So I can do that sum locally. I've got this factor and this factor, and I just do that little local sum, and all the rest of the graph doesn't matter. So I'm doing that little piece of sum. It's sort of breaking the graph into two parts. And I can kind of apply that recursively. I don't know if that makes it. It's not very complicated, actually. It's in chapter 8, if you... Okay.
That was an excellent talk. Thank you. I guess it follows on from that question over there. But in terms of convergence, like if you... the order in which you evaluate these things and pass the messages around... how large are the networks you've built to see if the oscillations are set up or if there's a different convergence based on your initial ordering of these things? Or is it pretty stable from that point of view?
Okay, so it's a good question. So it depends on the type of variables and depends on the structure of the graph. So for example, so there are two approximations really that are going on these graphs. If the graph is a tree, then we know you only have to send messages... you pick one node, call it the root node, send messages out to the leaves and back to the root, you're done. That gives you exact inference. So if it's a tree, there's a certain simplicity. Once you have loops, you have to be careful about sending information around the loops, and you can either map it into a more complex tree that's computationally very costly, or you can make an approximation where you just send little messages around and wait for convergence. The other approximation that's going on is the one that I mentioned, where if at each node we have to do an integration and we can't do it analytically, we make this local approximation of projecting back onto some family of simpler distributions. Now, does all this converge? It converges... it depends upon the topology of the graph, whether it has loops or not, and it depends upon which of those algorithms we're actually talking about. So, for example, the variational Bayes algorithm, at each step, is maximizing a rigorous lower bound on the quantity of interest. So it's guaranteed not to have oscillations and pathological behavior. It will converge, it may or may not converge to a good answer. That's actually quite a hard problem. We don't always use variational Bayes, we sometimes use other methods because they, although they don't have the same nice guaranteed convergence properties, they have other properties. They're able to get the model probability more accurately, for example. So I would say we're in an interesting situation where it's a very active research area. People are developing new variants of these algorithms. They're trying to understand how they relate to each other and fit into bigger families and so on. And so there's a lot of research being done. But there are a few basic algorithms that are well understood. We know when they work, we know when they break down. And those are the sorts of things we've included in infer.net, for example. So if you use sort of the fairly standard classes of models, Gaussian distributions and discrete variables and so on, and use one of those standard algorithms, then either because of theoretical results or a lot of history of using these in lots of different models, we know you're on reasonably safe ground, it's going to work fairly well. But there's still a very active research frontier there, so lots of work still to be done on these.
Can I just ask a quick one? Going back to the first question, really, about how you get domain knowledge in, and if there's a lack of domain knowledge and you don't want to do model inference, what do you do? So in your asthma example, you said there are sort of 700 SNPs in the genome which are known to vary and possibly are relevant variables in this, but we also know that there's probably a lot of structure there as well, that some of those may be in genes that are regulating expression of other genes, but my guess is that nobody could actually draw you the graph for that right now. So how do you model that in a way what's the appropriate kind of model to have for that, and will you ever acquire any additional knowledge from running these systems if you sort of fix on one solution?
Sure. So it's true, and in that case, there is more domain knowledge, population structure, and so on. We know about there are points where the genome is more likely to cross over, and other points which is less likely to cross over that induces correlations along the genome between the SNPs and so on. And we could model all of that. We're not doing that at the minute in our simple analysis, but we could build that into the model. This is actually a domain where there is a huge amount of very rich knowledge, and it's probably too complex to try to model it all. And the art of this is deciding what to model and what not to model. But it's still true that there are applications which actually you don't need much domain knowledge, where the problem isn't that complex, and where there's bucket loads of data, where actually, a neural network will actually do quite well. So I think there's a whole spectrum of problems. If you have lots of data, and it's a fairly simple thing you're trying to model, then you don't have to worry too much about this. The interesting situation is where you're modeling something very complex, where the data is very expensive, but maybe very noisy, and where you do have domain knowledge. I think the asthma is a good example of that, where it is worth making all of this effort to construct careful models that incorporate domain knowledge, because the domain knowledge is like a constraint. It says, let's just look at the whole space of possibilities. We'll constrain it very tightly to a much narrower space of possibilities that we believe contains the truth. And now our little bit of noisy data can find the solution within that smaller domain, whereas it would be lost in the larger domain. That's my intuition. That helps.
I guess if you asked an expert about the genetic data, they would tell you, we do know that this regulates that, and you would get a bit of data for your 700,000 cases or so, but very little. What you would primarily get is some sort of understanding of the notion of expression pathways and things like that. That you could model in an expert system as a set of sort of, a general schema about how that body, that system works. And it seems to me it's very hard to get that into your model, particularly if you don't allow any kind of model inference or any meta constraints on the class of models that you allow in. So I guess the question really is a bigger question about exactly how much of that domain knowledge do you think you can build in with these sort of probabilistic graphical models?
So just to focus on that specific example, it is true that we have a lot of detailed knowledge about the genome. These are not just independent observations, and they can be modeled, and my colleague John Wynn works closely with the Sanger Center, people like Richard Durbin, and they use exactly these same techniques of graphical models and approximate inference to describe all of those biomolecular and genetic effects and look for gene expression data and so on. So it can be done. We've actually adopted a slightly different approach because we're sort of coming as the beginners. We pretend we don't know anything, and what we'd like to see, does our method pick out those genes which most people think do have some sort of relationship to asthma, or does it pick out some completely irrelevant thing? It's sort of a sanity test. So in a sense, at the moment, what we're doing is just saying, does our model discover biologically plausible SNPs that we think are located on parts of the genome that it seems plausible to think have something to do with asthma? So that's more of a sanity check that there isn't something crazy with our model. But I think in due course we do want to incorporate this other domain knowledge. The danger, I think, is that if you incorporate domain knowledge that isn't true, not only can you reach the wrong conclusions, but you can reach the wrong conclusions and be very confident about them. So that's where the trade-off comes.
Sure. Okay, if there are no more questions. Thank you very much again.